time for A Story Told on KMUN. Your host, Michael McCusker, has been a regular voice on KMUN's airwaves since the 1980s. Each week, he shares commentary and writings about the current state of just about everything. In this week's show, Michael honors the opening of the 2026 Shanghai in Astoria theater season by reading a script he, as one of the actors in the theater troupe, used to perform years ago to open the show. And he remembers Bloody Thursday, the anniversary on July 5th of the violent 1934 West Coast waterfront workers' strike that left longshoremen dead after they clashed with police. The events of Bloody Thursday shocked the public and ignited a massive three-day San Francisco general strike. The resulting coast-wide solidarity ultimately forced owners to concede, securing worker-controlled union hiring halls and ending corrupt labor practices.
Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tonight is opening night of the 42nd season of Shanghai in Astoria. And 3 days ago, on July 5th, was the 92nd anniversary of Bloody Thursday, the most violent day of the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Labor Strike of 1934. I used to perform an oleo dialogue I wrote for the annual performance of Shanghai before opening curtain, a rant to prepare the audience for what they were in for. I hereby perform my shtick as my personal intro for Shanghai in Astoria premiere for 2026. I am Reno Finwinkel. I am a salmon fisherman. I got a sailing gillnet boat, a net, and a net shack. Every day I take a nap between my morning and afternoon net drifts. I go to sleep today in my shack like I always do. It's a summer day in 1900, but I wake up now in the year 2026, here in this Astoria, which is not my Astoria. Everything is so crazy. I wake up in a hole and I feel I am crawling out of my grave. I walk from Tongue Point and the brand new railroad tracks are rusty. I don't see no trains that take the salmon all over the world. Just a funny looking little trolley car that goes ding, ding. But it don't haul no fish. New houses I see being built all over Astoria's hills are old, or something weird looking is in their place. And I can't get nothing to eat at the Finnish meat market because it ain't a meat market no more. It is a playhouse, and the only thing even close to being meat are the live hams on the stage. I see great big steel ships anchored in the river, but I don't see no square rigger sailing ships, and I don't see no stern paddle steamboats. I don't see no fish boats, and the only canneries I see are abandoned and falling apart. I sure do see plenty of motor cars that try to run me down and honk at me like mad geese. My ears are almost deaf by the noises of machines, and my poor nose is tortured by stinking smells, not the good smells of fish and horses. Nobody I try to talk to is a fisherman or a sailor or works in a cannery. Nobody even knows what I'm talking about, except a girl with purple-yellow hair who's got rings in her eyebrows and her nose and her lips, and she's got a steel ball on her tongue. She tells me my Astoria burned down a century ago. She says there's no fish in the river no more, and the canneries closed down before she was born. She tries to tell me about spaceships to Mars and people on the moon. She says babies don't got to be born no more because everybody can duplicate themselves forever. And she says anybody can change sex anytime they want to. Oof, duh. I want to go back to my Astoria. I don't care if I gotta carry a gun so nobody steals my boat or my fish, or if maybe I'm drugged or beat up and shanghaied aboard a hell ship sailing to China. You got to understand, my Astoria is a real wild and wicked place. We got as many saloons as we got salmon in the river. Same day I catch the fish, I sell them and go to the saloons. And then maybe I go visit the ladies in the houses that got the red lights you use to stop motor cars with. So tonight, I am going to be shanghaied back to my Astoria. It will happen right here, and you are all coming with me. You betcha, by golly. And today is also Bloody Thursday, anniversary of the Great Maritime Strike of 1934. I wrote an article for my newspaper on its 60th anniversary in 1994. And I start with a quote from Mike Quinn. Stop in your tracks, you passerby. Uncover your doubting head. The working men are on their way to bury their dead. The men who sowed strength in their work and reaped a crop of lies are marching by. Oppression's doom is written in their eyes. Perhaps we should glance inward a trifle and take account of an anniversary that commemorates a bloody battle which occurred during the lopsided and never-ending labor wars in this country. July 5th is the 92nd anniversary of Bloody Thursday, the most violent day of the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934. San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike that summer, staged by labor unions in this country. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934, when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores as they were often called, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime unions, and through unanimous action, closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Grays Harbor, Portland, Astoria, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets and police fought bitter pitched battles with guns, gas, and clubs arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of ship owners, presidents of stevedoring companies, and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July, they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, the 70th anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg during the Civil War, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4th holiday provided a truce, and the day passed peaceably, But in the early morning of Thursday, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off when police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot to death by police revolvers, and several hundred suffered pistol wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant in the 1934 maritime strike and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. At 8 a.m., July 5th, promptly the police went into action, Quinn wrote. Tear gas bombs were hurled into the picket lines, and the police charged with their clubs. Gasping and choking, the strikers were driven back to the alleys off the Embarcadero or retreated up Rincon Hill. Shots rang out as police opened fire with revolvers. Flying bricks and bullets crashed windows. Tear gas sent workers in nearby factory and office buildings swarming into the streets. The whole area was swept by a surf of fighting men. Quinn quoted at a newspaper. The hottest battle took place in front of the ILA, International Longshoremen's Association, now the ILWU, International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, on Stewart Street, where scores were gassed, clubbed, and shot. Police cars literally filled the headquarters with gas from long-range guns, and persons entrenched there poured from the doors. Quinn wrote that workers on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, then under construction, were forced to abandon the job for the day because of stray bullets whistling around their heads. Police charged into the Seaboard Hotel, Quinn continued, where many strikers were quartered, and drove all occupants into the streets, swinging their long riot sticks and cracking skulls right and left. The building was filled with gas and riddled with pistol fire. Stubbornly holding their ground and fighting every inch of the way, the strikers were driven back into the city and off the Embarcadero. The battle swept over into the busy downtown district, endangering crowds of pedestrians. One picket, a striker, entrenched himself in a parking lot, devised a crude slingshot from old inner tube, and began bombarding Chief of Police William J. Quinn's, no relation to Quinn the writer, car with bricks. It took a barrage of tear gas and pistol fire to dislodge him. Scores of men littered the sidewalks, either lying silently or crawling away painfully on their hands and knees. A woman alighting from a streetcar at the Ferry Building screamed and collapsed when a bullet struck her in the temple. A man rushed to her assistance, was struck by another bullet, and crumpled to the street beside her. A Chronicle reporter described, quote, women who had been shopping in downtown stores arrived at the Loop to step into an inferno. With screaming children clinging to them, they disembarked from the cars to find themselves in clouds of smarting tear gas. Guns cracked. Men fell screaming as they went down. Police clubs cracked against skulls. Smothered and blinded by gas, the women and children staggered about helplessly. Policemen grabbed them as fast as possible and sent them to a hospital, where they were horrified by the sight of men dripping blood, moaning from bullet wounds and injuries. People in surrounding buildings were driven out by gas, and many were winged by stray bullets as they fired. At the height of the battle, a delegation from the strike committee, headed by Harry Bridges, called on Mayor Angelo J. Rossi to protest. The mayor simply repeated what acting California Governor Frank Merriman had said earlier, you refuse to arbitrate, now take the consequences. Hospitals were put on a wartime basis to accommodate the wounded. At the morgue, covered over by white sheets, were two cold, quiet bodies, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. The striking unions had men detailed to the hospitals to see that wounded pickets received adequate attention when brought in from the battlefield. These men reported later that injured strikers were threatened and intimidated by police when they stated that their club and gunshot wounds were caused by police officers. At the close of the day, Acting Governor Merriam ordered the National Guard onto the waterfront. 2,000 troops marched into the area equipped with rapid-fire guns, machine guns, gas equipment, and bayoneted rifles. By the time they arrived, the fighting had ceased and the pickets had been driven from the embarcadero. The guardsmen posted themselves at intervals down the whole length of the waterfront and mounted machine guns on the roofs of piers. Troops marched in wearing steel helmets and full service equipment. They set up camp inside the long, covered docks, established field kitchens, and remained there under wartime conditions. Divisions were brought in from Santa Rosa, Napa, Petaluma, Gilroy, and other outlying towns. Rumors were abundant to the effect that certain units had refused service, but strict censorship was maintained and definite confirmations were lacking. All day long, newspapers uptown had been pouring out extra after extra, delivering veritable hourly reports from the line of battle. Wailing sirens careening up and down Market Street aroused speculation and alarm among the public. The word blood, blood, blood recurred every three or four lines in every news story. So much blood had been seen that it obsessed the minds of news writers, and the word was repeated again and again, almost involuntarily as they typed their copy. The strikers named the day Bloody Thursday. On Monday, July 9th, 1934, a funeral march was held for Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast, the length of Market Street, behind trucks that carried the two coffins and flowers. A union band played a funeral march by Beethoven. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava, solemn strains of dirges and hymns, uncountable thousands of spectators lining the streets with uncovered heads. Overhead, a brilliant sun in the cloudless sky. Another newspaper said that the two dead strikers in life would not have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city, quote, unquote. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. For all practical purposes, Mike Quinn wrote, not a wheel moved or a lever budged. The official reaction was hysteria. The general strike was confused with revolution. Rumors and newspapers claimed that a communist arms was marching on the city from the north. Northwesterners were thought to be communists and radicals because of strong IWW activity the preceding decade. 500 extra policemen were hired, and thousands more National Guardsmen were sent to San Francisco from all over California. Police, red squads, raided strikers' homes and union offices. Vigilantes attacked and beat striking workers they accused of being communists. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934, and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition. Contracts were signed, and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions and a ban on blacklisting strikers from employment. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. Instead, there ensued a period of industrial guerrilla warfare, which persisted for more than 2 years, ultimately resulting from the whole Pacific Coast's maritime strike breaking out again in greater force than ever. The Great Maritime Strike of 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the United States. It heralded the vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO, and it set an example of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s. The 1934 strike is memorable because, above all, it demonstrated the power latent in the rank and file, Harry Bridges said a few years later. The rank and file not only manned the picket lines and did the sacrificing, as it must in every strike, but it also made the big decisions and determined the strategy. The rank and file would not be bulldozed or buffaloed, browbeaten or divided, and therefore it couldn't be licked. Once it knew the score, the rank and file could not be misled by any phony labor leader or panicked by any barrage of newspaper propaganda. And that was Harry Bridges. He also said, ultimately, the power of any union that serves as an instrumentality of the workers rests on the courage and conviction in its ranks. That is one of the fundamental truths that has not altered since 1934, nor will it in times to come. We have had strikes on the waterfront since 1934, Bridges said many years later, but never again have the bosses dared to shoot our men down in cold blood. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again by the thousands up Market Street in honor of the two dead strikers. One ship owner bitterly complained that every July 5th there is a complete cessation of work up and down the whole Pacific coast because of a holiday declared by the unions for the purpose of commemorating a day of violence and bloodshed, quote, unquote. No one authorizes the July 5th holiday excepting a 100% accord of the entire maritime profession, Mike Quinn wrote in The Big Strike, which was first published in 1949, 13 years after he wrote it, and 2 years before his death at age 41. Therefore, it is regarded as a completely unauthorized stoppage of work and an illegal act. The maritime unions have nothing by which to defend this annual disregard for authority other than an old, almost forgotten phrase in the yellow documents of the Revolution of 1776, which reads, by the consent of the governed. And that was by Mike Quinn, that last piece. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. Donald Trump is accused of posting a photo of his young self in a military school uniform as a pretense that he was in military service. He was sent by his parents to military boarding school, quote, for behavioral issues and bullying, unquote. Now he uses the photo to pretend he was in the military, and he remains a bully. Is there anything about Donald Trump that is not phony baloney?
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.